So, my name is Nicholas. Nicholas Robertson. I'm a member of the group called La Commune. We're the member group of the Northeastern Federation of Anarcho-Communists in Montreal, Canada.
Okay, so I wonder how you got involved in the group or how the group came together?
Well, it's kind of a long story. The NIFAC group in Montreal goes back to 2001, which was 3 years ago right now, and we had a big anti-globalization protest in Quebec City at that time. It's the Summit of the Americas, and NIFAC as a federation already existed since April 2000, but in Montreal, there was only one supporter group leading up to the summit in the year before that, and a few scattered individual members. And after the summit, we felt that we didn't really exist as a group. We formed as a group to join the federation, so we felt the need to be more organized following like that large anti-globalization protest. I could go more into that later, but that's when we started forming a group. And through that, it was maybe only four or five individuals. And I guess maybe a year later, we started growing. And some people have come and left. But at this point, we're about 12 members with three or four supporters.
What's the structure of your group? Is it like an affinity group? Is it more formal?
We use, contrary to lots of other collectives in the Federation, we use the branch structure. So what we're trying to do is gather everybody that's a NIFAC member in Montreal into one group. And we have like a very formal structure with a treasury and an internal secretary and external secretary. And what we do to get our work done is form working groups. In the past, we had long-term working groups, like one that was specifically concentrated on workplace struggles, another one that was concentrated on immigration struggles. After problems with that, we moved away from it because people would get like I don't know how to say, maybe isolated in those working groups. We would never like come together as a larger group. We'd just be doing our working group activity all the time. So recently we've changed to like ad hoc working groups. So we're on campaigns. So in our general meetings, we decide what we want to campaign on, and we form then specific working groups for that. Right now we have mainly a working group on fighting the Liberal government, right-wing government in Quebec.
Okay. And is that the kind of activities you did when you started up together? And how did kind of Black Bloc tactics fit into that?
Well, it's, in Montreal, it's different, and I guess the common perception I think people have of NIFAC here amongst in anarchist circles here in Ireland or elsewhere in Europe is that lots of groups were doing Black Bloc for a while as a NIFAC group, but us wasn't like that. We as individuals would take part in the Black Bloc. But from the beginning that we formed an NIFAC group, we had already moved away from that tactic. And what was important for us was to have like a visible political face of anarchism in movements. So, yeah, as soon as we started existing, never has there been like a NIFAC Black Bloc in Montreal. We protest without masks and with banners, and we like to hand out leaflets and papers.
And I mean, how many kind of other anarchists would be in Montreal? Would they still use a Black Bloc tactic, or would you be in the same demonstrations in the same areas as them?
Yeah, I think I'd say right now, if you like consider specifically Black Bloc tactics and like not just confrontational protests in a larger sense, I'd say no one in Montreal uses Black Bloc tactics now. But at that time in 2001, it was still very popular, and these groups weren't public, and they weren't like formally organized. They had like informal structures, which you call affinity groups. So it's hard to tell like how many there were exactly, but I'd say maybe you'd have 5 to 10 of those affinity groups, and in different protests you have different numbers of people, but I'd average it at about like a hardcore group of 50 people that were into those tactics for a long time. We actually had a protest, a specifically anarchist May Day protest in 2000, and we marched to the richest neighborhood in Montreal, which is called Westmount, and everybody was Black Bloc then, so that was, I guess, the height of the Black Bloc in Montreal, and it was maybe 200 people, all masked, all dressed in black. And I guess we did scare the rich, but the police weren't scared, and they circled everybody, and most of us were arrested. So, yeah, and the march lasted about 12 minutes.
So did the change from the Black Bloc to, well, what is there still confrontational street tactics or confrontational street demonstrations?
Sure, like we still mask up if the need presents. Like if you start a protest and everything is peaceful, and then that's fine, you know. And but eventually, police try to break up the protest, or we head to some place like the Parliament building, and there's a police line protecting it. We're not shy to like push through police lines if we have to, and use force if it's necessary to achieve a goal. So it's not that we've become a total pacifist, and it's just more it's less, I guess, how can you say,
that we're using it more as a tactic now than as a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Like before, it was like the strategy is to confront the police every time seeing the police, but now it's more like if we march and there's no problem, and that our goal is more to pass our message, then we walk and we don't care about the police. But if like there's some attacks or whatever, then we react and we're not shy of it. And even I can say that we're not masked anymore when we confront the police.
Mm-hmm.
And
it used to be, I guess what I was trying to say is that it used to be really more staged. Like people would like prepare days in advance and like make backpacks full of stuff and get dressed just the right way. And there's even this funny story about before one of the anti-globalization protests, like one of my friends who's just like an anarchist supporter, and he was never involved in any of this, but he'd come to all the protests, and he walked into a restaurant near the meeting point, and he saw a bunch of people looking at themselves in the mirror and checking to see if their gas mask was like well placed, and they were looking sharp with their black hoodies and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was very staged at one point, you know. Like it seemed like the more preparation there was to the street confrontation, the less actual confrontation happened. Because these people would get like very paranoid and nervous, because like you can imagine what they had in their backpacks, and since they were so like on edge and careful of what they were going to do, nothing really happened. And now it seems like just to like be involved in the protest in a more natural way, the confrontation comes out also naturally.
So it was more a tactical difference than a political difference, or was there also political reasons to change?
Yeah, I like, this is just my personal opinion about it, and I like other people who were part of that probably have like a different interpretation of what happened. But what I'm thinking back to it seems like at that time, and we're pretty much young people, anarchists in North America, at that time we were just getting involved in politics. And there were already movements for us to be involved in, like the student movement in Quebec, which was a starting point for lots of anarchists. It was very strong in the mid-90s. And then after the student movement, there was the anti-globalization movement. And it seemed like there wasn't a need to build anything. Like, it already existed. And being, like, you know, mostly working class, dissatisfied youth, like, that was already there in front of us. And it seemed like all we had to do was, like, be really radical in that. And be really radical in the street. So that's why it seemed to be sufficient to just, like, not organize politically at all, and that our only means of organization would be, like, street organization. But following, like, the anti-globalization movement is, like, almost dead in North America at this point. And so following that, we sort of felt the need that, well, we have to build, like, popular movements. And some popular movements, like, already do also exist, but we have to have a stronger anarchist presence in them. So then NEFAC made the shift to, like, getting involved in what we call bread and butter struggles, so workplace struggles and community-based struggles. So I think, like, building an anarchist pole, or the need to build an anarchist pole in those struggles, like, forced us to move away from just organizing in a tactical way, a street tactics way. So I think that was the point where we said, well, it's going to take more than organizing a radical protest. Like, we'll have to have, like, politics and, like, good papers and, you know, a strategy to build larger movements.
Mm-hmm. So you were saying the change in tactics, you had more or less everybody in Montreal kind of dropped the Black Bloc nearly at the same time? Or?
It was gradual. Without bragging, I guess we could say we were some of the first to drop it, and that wasn't really received pretty well because people kind of, well, rightly saw a shift between, like, having these secret non-public groups and then moving to, at the same time, to something that's, like, has a public face to it. Like, in fact, we have a website, and we organize public meetings. And if we organize a protest, we'll speak publicly as anarchists, like, without a mask on. And we're slightly criticized that in the beginning, saying, like, oh, well, you don't want to do, like, radical stuff anymore. All you want to do is sit down and discuss your politics and or write for a paper. And but through time, like, I think people have accepted that it's kind of a smart thing to do. The first years we were as a group, we were one of the only groups that had, like, a literature table. So we were the only people, like, distributing magazines from other groups or books on anarchism or pamphlets on anarchism. And today, gradually more and more of what used to be, like, affinity groups have organized into, like, more formal groups, and they're distributing more and more literature too.
Mm-hmm. Adding to that, one reason that make people gradually leave the Black Bloc tactic was repression. Because in Montreal, like, we have a history of mass arrest, like, since 2000, I guess, since May Day 2000, where 157 people were arrested. After that, it was, like, more and more people. Even, like, on March 15, 2002, it was 371 arrests. So, like, they circle everybody, and you just charge after, and you have years and years in trial, and that start to pissing off people. And I guess that the people I know that kind of try to use that still Black Bloc tactics today, you know, and they are alone in their corner asking for people, come, we're going to smash the window, and nobody wants to go. They've never been arrested yet. So it's more easier when you don't have, like, criminal record to go do your stuff and then run. But then when you are trapped into that, like, 4 years trial or whatever, and then you can cross the border as NEFAC, you know, like, we're in Quebec, but also in the United States. So if you can cross the border, you can attend meetings and all this shit. So I guess that for us, I think it was one reason to leave Black Bloc tactics, repression.
Do you think that the Black Bloc tactics ever actually worked, like in their own terms? If you were to do it all again, would you do it?
There are definitely some high points. I was at the protests against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. in April of 2000. And, like, that was, like, I guess the next big anti-globalization protest after Seattle in North America. And that at that time, we, I guess what you can call the pre-NEFAC, which was, like, the, I guess the same collectives that eventually became NEFAC, but we weren't organized much as a federation at that point, but the collectives from the East Coast of the U.S. and Canada or decided to call for a revolutionary anti-capitalist Black Bloc, you know. And we, I think it's probably one of the largest anarchist contingents I've been in my life. It was like 1,500 to 2,000 people, and we started off like smaller at the beginning of the day, and during the day more and more people joined us because it was part of like a larger protest where there were 20 to 30,000 people or maybe a bit more. And that was successful because we were important enough that the rest of the left, I guess the more moderate left who were organizing the protests, couldn't ignore us. And not myself, but people living in the U.S. were invited to planning meetings, and they had their part in planning the larger protest. And that day, the tactic wasn't to like just do property damage or anything. The tactic was to help the nonviolent protesters, because at that time it was very popular to do like lockdowns. So the strategy was to try to close the city with people blocking street corners and like linking arms, locking down. And so when police would try to disperse the nonviolent protesters, well, we would confront the police on the front line. So, and it was neat because like it was pretty successful, and at the end of the day, like you had like all these nonviolent protesters cheering us on, and they were happy we'd prevent them from getting arrested.
And I think too that at least in North America, when Black Bloc tactics in that big protest start, it makes the anarchists alive again. Because you don't have this long tradition as you have in Europe of anarchism. And that in those summits, you know, like anarchists were in all newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so that just make people, oh yeah, anarchists exist. And anarchism was viewed as the main political force behind those action. So that was great too, because behind those action was you know, a basic discourse that I can say against capitalism, you know, and that's it was new too, you know, to talk about capitalism and not only like neoliberalism, you know, that the roots of the problem was capitalism. And I think that's it was a good point, you know, but but after that, you know, we move away from it because, like, we had a different idea. We wanted to build a revolutionary organization. But I guess that when it first started, it was, like, all this good thing that happened. And just toward that NEFAC was created after, you know, Seattle and blah, blah, blah. Because people were meeting, and then people were also talking about, yeah, maybe now it's, you know, it's... it's time to change and to go forward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all this new organization start to create in North America after those big protests. So I think it was nice, you know?
Yeah, Black Bloc definitely helped anarchism be popular again in North America, as she said. But through time, it seemed like it was less and less anarchists in the Black Bloc, and just generally... all sorts of other kinds of people. Like right now, I guess coming back to Montreal, I think the tactic is most popular amongst Maoists, the anarchists actually. And instead of calling it the Black Bloc, they call it the Red Fist, but it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, everybody that would join the Black Bloc would then get interested in anarchism and start reading on about it. But it seemed as more and more things went on, all kinds of political tendencies were claiming to be part of the Black Bloc, probably rightly so.
Yeah, when I was in Genoa, it was just scary. At one stage, we were running down the street, and there was a big 6-foot flag of Chairman Mao. But do you think that groups like the Maoists today, are they succeeding on the back of the Black Bloc tactic? Is it helping them to get bigger? Is it working for them?
Not really. Only with youth, college kids that start getting interested. But I think it's not really because they're using Red Fist or Black Bloc tactic. It's more because they're this kind of authoritarian organization that tell you what you have to do and tell you the way you should do this and that. So young people just say anarchism is just, it's nice, but it's going anywhere because you have to think, by yourself, and you have to take initiative, and you have to be ambitious too, and you have to believe. But when you you have this kind of authoritarian organization that tell you everything, you just follow it to it. So I guess that, at least it's my point of view, that this college kids when they're interested in Maoist, it's from that, before anything else, before Black Bloc tactics.
Yeah, they do recruit lots of young people, but there's a high turnover rate in the organization. So, like she said, people get easy answers there, but I think at some point they just get tired of the easy answers and move on.
But can I say something more on the last question about the Black Blocs and in North America? It's just also what it help is that direct action gets the good. And just an example, at the Summit of the America in Quebec City, there was a huge Black Bloc, and there was two march at the same time, one called from by the anarchists and the other by big unions. But there was all this big fence.
Yeah, a fence surrounding where they were, the leaders of the heads of state of the Americas were holding their summit.
And this fence was really in a popular neighborhood, and that was dividing the people, And the big union, their march was going to a parking lot, really far away from the fence. But the anarchists were going directly to the fence. Because it was not only because the big leaders were meeting there, but it was also because it was in a working class neighborhood, and that was pissing off people, that to have this big fence. And I guess that
we weren't there, but they say 10,000 to 15,000 rank and file from the unions broke away from the peaceful march and joined the Black Bloc.
Yeah, and they went to crash the fence, and people were happy with that, So it just an example that it also helped people to get a bit radicalized and to say, yeah, we don't have to always follow those reformist leaders, and that get take direct action.
And it's funny today to make a link with what's just said, is that with those big, it's a whole other question, but there's a big social movement against the Liberal government in Quebec, and unions are a big part of that. And some of the rank and file initiatives in that movement have been in terms of direct action and radical tactics have surpassed anything an anarchist could dream of. So we don't have to worry. The rank and file of unions can do it themselves.
What do you think? You were saying earlier on that people kind of move from maybe the summer hop and stuff and the kind of street confrontations. Do you think that's one of the reasons for the decline of the anti-globalization movement in North America, or is there a lot of external factors as well?
Well, I think what we forget a lot is that the initial goal we had of like shutting down summits or making them hard to organize and hard for these leaders to meet was achieved. You know, like after Seattle and then Washington D.C. and then maybe Quebec City was the last time. They had a few meetings in Ottawa, which is Canada's capital. But then the last time the GA came, they met in the woods of Alberta, which is like a western province in Canada. And it's like in the middle of nowhere. So like that succeeded. And then maybe people were wondering, well, we've managed to prevent these meetings or at least make them very hard to happen. But like, what else do we want, you know? And I think then it went into all sorts of other directions. Like, yes, like the anti-globalization protest movement is dead in North America, but people have like moved on to like there's all kinds of different groups in Montreal, like the No One Is Legal group that works for immigrants' rights, and there's the CLAC Housing. CLAC was the network of people organizing anti-globalization stuff, but a specifically pro like tenants' rights housing group came out of that, and they do like community organizing in a specific neighborhood in Montreal. And well, us, like our NIFAC group solidified, and so. Yeah, we kind of like achieved our goal, that the initial goal, and then there just didn't seem to be so much to do after that, like in terms of these protests. So we moved on to like more specific struggles.
Do you think it's like things moving from kind of a spectacular rhythm to a more kind of sustainable long term thing?
Yeah, I think it's also important not to forget that like the policies of like the International Monetary Fund, for example, are being implemented by like local governments. And like right now, the fight in Quebec is against the provincial government. But like we can't forget that what we were protesting against a few years ago in terms of IMF policies, well, that's basically what the Liberal government's implementing right now, you know, like changing labor laws and cutting public services, like, so the politics are still there. And what was the last question again?
That's actually about the decline of the anti-globalization movement.
Yeah, we were saying in our talk last night, it seemed like a few years ago it was harder to, you know, we'd have to have link the global to the local, and that wasn't always very successful because like ordinary people didn't necessarily understand like why there was this largely youth-based movement against globalization or this like lefty-based movement against globalization. But it seems easier now to link the local to the global in terms of the instead of like vice versa.
Okay, so I'm talking to Nicholas and Evelyn. They're from a group called the Commune in Quebec, and they're part of the NIFAC Federation. They're involved at the moment in struggles against the right-wing Liberal government and its cutbacks. So we're going to talk about that now. Evelyn, do you want to introduce yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
My name is Evelyn. I'm a daycare worker, and I'm involved in NIFAC since 3 years now. And that's it, I guess.
Okay, so the Liberal Party are only in power for about a year, yet there seems to be a lot of opposition against them. Why is it so strong against them so fast? What went beforehand?
Pourquoi qu'il y a autant d'opposition pour le manque de
rêve? Is it Emma here?
She is inside.
Okay.
Basically, I guess what you can say is that what people call neoliberalism, sort of this most like recent attack and transformation of capitalism and attack by the ruling class on working class like standards of living and rights, like it didn't really happen that intensively in Quebec until just recently. So like. Throughout the 80s and 90s, we had like a social democratic government called the Parti Québécois, and social democratic, but they were always moving a bit more to center. But we didn't have like huge cutbacks until the mid 90s, And at that time, well, then the government, which was the Parti Québécois, did turn out to be very neoliberal. But they always had this kind of, they kept the reputation as being social democratic. And them being like the nationalist party in Quebec, lots of people just continued supporting them for that and didn't necessarily want to like protest some of their cutbacks because of like keeping up that nationalist support. But with the Liberals, it's just that it's become like very clear. Like there's no more like screen to it. It's wide open, and the Liberal election promises were reducing taxes by $1 billion and investing in health, and which we haven't really seen. But the tax cut, the $1 billion tax cut, is well, going to be made up by like cutting public services and raising the cost of public services. So, like for the first time, people are seeing like public transport costs go up, heating costs go up, daycare costs go up, and then also there's like lowering everybody's wages through attacks on the labor movement. So they're changing labor laws and trying to crush unions. So it's just like people's lives, like from the morning when they get up to going to bed at night, like it's everywhere around them. Like they're paying more to go to work. Their union's being busted at work, or they might be earning less soon because of subcontracting. And then they come home and they have a more expensive heating bill to pay. So it's very like in your face, like attack on like working class people's standards of living.
Evan, you're a daycare worker, and that's been something that's been affected specifically. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, in Quebec, we had a big network of public daycare center. That's coming from the 70s, from mostly women activists that were involved in community-based group like in housing and food, and they start.
So was it kind of a like feminist activist or just female activist?
Feminist too, I think. Female and feminist at the same time, and they start creating daycare center, and they were asking for fund by the government. And that took time, and they were even like when they had no money, they were like being a voluntary to make the daycare center alive, to help working class women to go to work or whatever they have to do. And finally, throughout the years, in 1998, the government decided to put this huge amount of money in daycare center and to subvention them at 85%.
Just subvention is subsidized.
Subsidize.
Subvention is English.
My mistake. Yeah. Sorry.
Subsidize them at 85%. So, and the basic, the principle behind that was to give everybody a chance. Because it was the costs were being to be universal, so it was $5 a day for everybody, like rich or poor, whatever. It was just like everybody at the same level, and that was the principle behind it. And it was really a great thing that happened. And elsewhere in Canada, it was like really seeing as, wow, like Quebec is doing really good in daycare center, because it was supposed to create 200,000 places for kids. And at the same time, by giving subvention of 85%, it was also increasing the wages of daycare workers, which is mostly women, that before we were not pay like zoo workers were paid most.
Okay, yeah.
And it was a big thing in Quebec, you know, that you want people that take care of your kids to be less paid than people that just look at animals, you know. And so now with the attacks, the costs have risen of 40%. It's now $7 a day, which is not so big, $2, but it's even 40% most and more. And there's no, you know, they have, the government let him space to higher the cost every year. So we don't know if it will stay 7 for like how many time, we don't know. And also what it did is that like pay equity, what was supposed to give to daycare workers, and that's not be planned for, will not be redone for, I think, the next 10 years. You know?
Sorry, is pay equity with daycare workers, as in?
Pay equity is like gender equity in pay. Okay, so like traditional jobs that are like based with women-based jobs are paid less. So it's to like to average out like wages and make it more equitable in terms of women gaining as good a wage as men.
Mm-hmm. And as they cutting the subvention, daycare worker will not see their wages being higher, and even to say pay equity will not happen. Mm-hmm. I think in the next 10 years.
And pay equity. So was that like a government goal or?
No, it was a demand of unions, and government has granted to some work,
yeah,
to some unions and to some trades. I used to be working in the hospital and in the kitchen of a hospital. I was a kitchen worker there, and it was considered a female based job, and our union won pay equity, but it's granted to everybody who works there. So like if you, man or woman, it's like the type of job that counts. It's
mm-hmm.
not your gender. Mm-hmm. And we won like huge amounts of money. Like I wasn't working there for very long, but I got a few $1,000s from that, and people that were working there for years like got like thousands and thousands of dollars. So it's pretty important, you know.
But the government passed a law to oblige company to pay to women pay equity. But the thing is that they are the most d'enfants, c'est eux le boss le plus chiant.
You're the toughest boss in government.
The government is the toughest boss because with like public employee, you know, that asking for pay equity, they are going in trial for years and years because they refuse to pay women pay equity. At the same time, they pass a law to oblige like some company to do it. So like in daycare workers, we're not, like as we are working for the government, we'll not see that happen soon. And I think for daycare centers, it's all about that. But it's all this thing that now universality will not exist really anymore, and because the subvention is going to develop private daycare center. But at private daycare center, the cost is like $30 or $40 a day instead of $5. So it's making a big difference. So it's who can afford to go there? It's rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you able to pay that, and when some public daycare center are getting less and less subvention, so they're getting less money,
mm-hmm.
Is that it's create a kind of two...
two-tier system.
Yeah, two tier.
Yeah, so you get better like.
Okay, so can you tell us about some of the popular movements against the cutbacks of the Liberal government?
Sure. There's popular movements on many fronts. Obviously, one of the biggest elements in them is unions. Then there's also the community groups, like the housing groups, the anti-poverty groups that are mobilized. Students have been mobilized, and it's made for like very large protests in the province. Throughout the fall, there were protests of like 20, 30, 40,000 people in front of the Parliament building in Quebec City. And recently, May Day in Montreal, which is, May Day has a much smaller tradition in North America than in Europe. We had 100,000 people at the May Day demo this past May Day in Montreal. So there's been large protests, but also direct action, you could say. And there's been rank and file initiatives to disrupt the government activity. And on December 11th, there was a big day of economic disruption, and the port of Montreal was blocked, and the Quebec City port was also blocked, and roads were blocked throughout the province. So there was lots going on.
Okay. And have these kind of movements given people confidence to keep going, or?
Yeah, this kind of, well, I think people want more. They don't necessarily have the confidence to take it up in their hands and actually do it themselves, and they seem to be waiting for leadership to do it, but people definitely want more, and there's actually lots of general strike mandates that have been voted in unions. So some workers are really ready to go forward, but the whole like labor machine, the labor leadership has been like moving through this very slowly.
Mm-hmm. And I think that now people are starting to be fed up because they want more, you know, because they see everything being cut back and no victory at all. If we had like 3,000, you know, decentralized action on December 11, and then the bigger mayday we ever had in Quebec, still the government doesn't care and cut again. So people are starting to be fed up because, like, the big leadership unions are just waiting, and they promised that, like in December, just before Christmas, they were having all this class war speeches, like, this is attacks on the working class, we have to build a workers' power, and then after, it's like, silence, you know? But people, like, in their life, they feel the cuts back, and, you know, they don't want that. But there's all this tension now that's coming because people want to strike, you know, want to do some direct action, but the leadership, what they want is to sit again on the table to negotiate. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same thing at all.
Mm-hmm. What's the kind of current place of anarchism in the popular movements or of anarchists, and how would you like to see that develop?
We have a small role to play. I think in terms of numbers, we're pretty much overwhelmed. Like when you think of 100,000 people demonstrating that day in Montreal May Day, we had an anarchist contingent that was like no more than 700 people, which is still pretty good, but like we were just a drop in the ocean, like the 700 out of 100,000. But like beyond, like we've also been able to, like when there's days of action, to organize our specifically anarchist actions and disrupt the government in our way. So we have our place, but beyond that, we kind of like to be involved more on a day-to-day basis in this, but it's hard because not all of us are unionized, or even only a small minority of us are unionized. And it's like there's actually a NEFAC comrade in Quebec City who's a hospital worker, and he's part of, like, the hospital workers are very mobilized in this, and he does as much as he can, and he's part of, like, he puts out the union newsletter and takes part in general assemblies, but he's, like, all alone in this very large union that has, like, assemblies of hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. So, and as Evelyn said, she's a daycare worker, and the daycare workers are also very mobilized, but it seems like anarchists are isolated lots of times in their workplaces and don't take part in the unions in a coordinated way. So we'd like to, like, with time, become more coordinated and a more significant pull on in everyday, like, social movements. Mm-hmm. That's a good ending.